Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second episode of Les Experts Breaking the Lines English Speaking Podcast. I'm Louis, and today I'm joined by... You guys can introduce yourselves.
Jack Louis. Greater Breaking the Lines.
Yeah, Maher Mizahi, an Algerian football journalist from Algiers.
Thomas.
Thomas, co-founder, Breaking the Lines right here.
I guess that rounds out everybody. Let's just jump straight into it then.
So Maher Mizahi, Thomas Anderson, Louis Jack, and Zach Louis here to present the second podcast of Breaking Lines. All right, so here today, it's been a long week. It's been a really, really long week, and I think that's because of international break, or maybe it's just me, but what do you guys?
I think it cuts out at the end.
So, I mean, this always happens, okay? You know, you got that one chunk of the year where you don't have any international break. Now it's back on. So it seems to be a nuisance for everyone. You know? It seems to be like... It seems to be just an unnecessarily huge chunk of our time. So do you feel like it needs to change for the fans? Because I don't know a single fan who's satisfied with it.
I think it depends because, of course, there's the idea qualifies. I mean, we're not going to get to a World Cup with a limited amount of nations when there are hundreds of nations on Earth without having going to two qualifies. But the format where it's in, we're split into 2 weeks, all the qualifiers can be spread over those 2 weeks. You know, 1 week, some of the qualifiers the first week, and some of the qualifiers the next week, and then every team plays a friendly. I feel that's just really badly done. You know, it's mainly so with the sponsors can get the revenue money from the amount of people watching.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think it's a fairly Eurocentric way of looking at things because I think usually the fans that you say are a little bit bored with the international break are fans of the clubs, like you know, the top four, the Champions League clubs. But I think if you go outside of Europe, I think people really, really cherish the international break. If people have been following the South American qualifiers, for example, you've been having crazy games there, very entertaining.
Yeah,
South
American qualifiers.
Yeah, great atmospheres. Yeah. And go speak to somebody from Chile who, you know, probably doesn't watch Arsenal every week and doesn't get to see Alexis Sanchez in the flesh every week, and they probably do relish those international breaks. So I think maybe in Europe with, you know, the elite leagues and the elite clubs, that might be the case. But if you step out of that and you go into Africa, Asia, and South America, I think people have a lot more appreciation for these international breaks.
But are the friendlies necessary? That's my question. Because I mean, there are key players in the long stretch will get injured during a friendly, which the only goal is to really, like, you know, make money for sponsors. I mean, do we really need... Can't we just keep the friendlies to summer, don't you think?
In South America, there were qualifiers, I think, this break. But you're right, in Africa, there are friendlies. I think in Europe, they're qualifying as well, if I'm not mistaken. So they're not always qualifiers. Some weeks they're qualifiers, some weeks they're friendlies. You say that because, again, if you're looking at it from a club's perspective, you would be afraid that your players get injured. But that Alexis Sanchez belongs to Chile just as much as he belongs to Arsenal. And Chilean fans are chuffed with him playing week in, week out as well. So, I mean, there's two ways of looking at it.
I mean, these nations, what can they do? What can these players, like in Africa, for example, there's no qualifiers at the moment. What can they do? All of the players are off just doing nothing. Might as well get your team together, you know, see if you can coach some of the team some more, see if you can implement your tactical ideas a bit more when there's time, when everyone else is off. It's a much wider problem. It's something FIFA has to look at. Completely, you know, reorganizing the whole thing if there has to be change.
And you've got to make it more inclusive too, because I mean, everybody complains that AFCON is in winter, but it's literally like impossible to do AFCON during the summer, which, you know, also makes me worried for the 2022 World Cup, but that's a different story.
So that's another debate in and of itself, because I mean, it is possible to have AFCON within the months of, let's say, May and August, if you play in the southern hemisphere, if you play in South Africa, where it's winter over there. But yeah, you're right. In most of the continent, it'd be really hot. But I think the reason why they play 2 years, I mean, they give completely different reasons. They'll say it's that so we have more tournaments, so more countries can build sporting infrastructure and help grow the game on the continent. So it's a big, excuse the language, but it's a big FU to Europe, to FIFA, to CAF. To Europe, to FIFA, and to UEFA. They really don't care. For them, every 2 years is great. And like you said, it brings sponsorship money in. And that's the most important. However, a new CAF president was elected on the 16th of March, so just approximately 10 days
finally,
ago.
Finally, after and, 39 years.
That was 29 years. 29 years of this. We're not going to make it more of a thing than 10 years. So there is a new president of CAF, and that's one of the things that he did run on, was that he would examine the Africa Cup of Nations and see if they were going to maybe reevaluate how long it's played and the frequency of it.
Yeah. No, to your credit, I do believe that it is a Eurocentric concept. I mean, you know, football revolves around Europe. You know, if you're good enough in Africa, you're going to go to Europe. If you're good enough in South America, you can go to Europe. And you know, Tomas, you're Ghanaian, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Meher, you are Algerian. So yeah. I think that there is some credit and maybe even a necessity for this to happen because of the financial situation, Europe will take the players after South America. And so I think that there this kind of maybe developing a culture, if you will, in terms of football, it doesn't allow them to, coaches to maybe do enough tactically before they go off to play. So I think this is one way of paying back that dividend, don't you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And like you said, I mean, these international breaks are a good opportunity for coaches because Arsene Wenger gets to work with his players on a daily basis. But let's say the new coach of the Ivory Coast, Mark Wilmots, he's only going to have his players with him every 2 or 3 months. Yeah. It's very difficult to instill tactical schemes and work with your players tactically and things like that if you don't have these breaks every 2 months or so. And even that's too little for a lot of international coaches. So, I mean, there's always going to be inconveniences. And you're right that it is Eurocentric. And in a sense, it makes sense because Europe has the money. They're paying the most. So their needs are always going to be put ahead of others. But just to make the point that not everybody hates it, I don't think everybody hates it.
Yeah, no. Do you think that on the tactical side, do you think that we need to do more to get better international coaches? Because it seems to me that the best coaches are on club level. You know, with Conte and Del Bosque leaving, we don't really have any giants in terms of international coaches. I mean, there are some good coaches such as, you know, Chris Coleman, you know, Lowe.
Martinez.
Yeah, Martinez.
Even then, these guys are not the best in the world, you know.
Yeah, exactly. When we had like 6 months ago, we had Conte amongst you know, some of the most well-refined coaches in the world, and now we're looking at what the most average batch of international coaches we've seen for such a long time, and it's because international football is really being disregarded in a way, and rightfully so, because you brought up the point earlier about them having less time to, you know, work with the players, which is why so many of them opt to go over to club football, which is also, you know, quite understandable. But I feel that maybe if we regulate the whole winter break thing, or if we regulate a better international break system, then more coaches will be persuaded to switch over or to do dual coaching. That could happen.
Yeah, it's not just that. I think everything comes back to money as well. International coaches work with their players less, so they get paid less. And I think a lot of these coaches just won't accept to work for a salary of less than 7-8 million euros. I mean, Roy Hodgson, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he was the highest paid coach at the Euro, and he's making a third of what Arsene Wenger is making at Arsenal. So I don't think it'd be very hard to persuade some of these top coaches to go become an international coach, simply because they get to work with their players less, so they have less of an influence with them, and also because they get paid less consequently.
So do you guys think that there should be some sort of structural changes to when international football takes place? So instead of it, you know, being spread out across the season, essentially, have the whole batch of the season in one go, and then after that do international football?
I personally don't see an easy solution. I think the scheduling is always going to be hectic. And I think no matter how little or how few you take your players away from clubs, they're going to be unhappy about it. Honestly, I don't see it. I haven't thought about it much, but I don't see a better model than what exists today. But again, I might be wrong. Maybe you guys have an input on that.
I think the players definitely like it more than the fans, you know.
Yeah, certainly. I'd love to represent my country, you know. Anything.
Not only that, if you don't represent your country, you're taking a 2-week break, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
And I think players want to play, they want to play as much football. The clubs don't want that to happen. But I mean, for some rare people like Meher, who don't really have clubs and actually prefer internationals to club football, I think that offers a special opportunity. I mean, especially for me, from my perspective, I have an extremely limited viewpoint of the U.S. men's national team in comparison to teams I'll never watch, like in Portugal and in Italy. Never watched live, but so I do think that it does force you, maybe in some ways, to reconnect with your nations. Although, I mean, we all see, we all see international games as a nuisance. But when it comes to tournament time, we're all ready to go.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, what do you guys really think football is about? I mean, for me, I've been watching football seriously, like on a daily basis for about a decade now. And for me, the best of football is when you really have a story almost like Leicester City's last year, you know, where the momentum is building and everybody's believing in this story that didn't seem realistic. And it's just a fairy tale is happening. And for me, that happens more on the international level than it does at the club level, because let's be honest, again, money dominates, money rules. And most of the time you have the same clubs winning the championships, winning the Champions League. And so in international football, at every World Cup, you'll have these minnows. At every Euro, you'll have, you know, Iceland or Northern Ireland. And even if they don't win it, just the fact that they qualify to these tournaments, or just the fact that they put in good performances like Albania did, they'll come back and they'll be heroes back home. So I think for me personally, that's why I prefer international football, because I think there's better stories in it.
So Maher, what do you see as the best story right now in international football in Africa?
I mean, the Cameroon winning the Cup of Nations was pretty spectacular.
Yeah, that was massive.
That was really great, because, I mean, before they went to the Cup of Nations, seven of their biggest players pulled out, from Joel Matip at Liverpool to, young players like Anguissa at Marseille. A lot of people just refused to show up at the Cup of Nations because they didn't agree with the coach. So nobody gave Cameroon a living chance in hell, and somehow they pulled that off. For me, that was a great story. And the narrative, especially them playing Egypt in the final, where you had Hector Cooper on the bench for Egypt, who was sort of seen as this notorious loser. I think he's lost 5 or 6 finals now, cup finals. And just that suspense of, is he finally going to, you know, get the monkey off his back? Or are Cameroon going to pull it off without these seven players? For me, that was a good story in and of itself. But you also had, again, minnows like Equatorial Guinea. Or sorry, I apologize. Like Guinea-Bissau.
Yeah.
Who made it to the first Cup of Nations, and who had 50-60% of the country out on the streets after, you know, watching their matches on big screens. That's a story in and of itself. So I like the Cup of Nations because they had a lot of stories like that. Right now, for this break, I haven't been paying attention, to be honest, but I don't think there are any really stories that jump out at me like that.
For CONCACAF.
So,
no, go ahead.
Yeah, so a quick, just to play devil's advocate, you guys say, whatever your opinion is, that international football has the better story, which might be right, of course, but would you not say that club football is just a lot better quality-wise?
I think it's because we're used to the club football fairy tale story. I mean, something like Leicester, of course not, because that happens every once in a blue moon. But the fact that international football is, you know, like only a couple of times a year, which means only a few times we can see a special story like that happen, means that we're more surprised by it. It makes him feel more special.
Valid point. Very valid point.
No, but I do think Thomas has a good point. I think the better football is played, you know, in the Premier League. You have the better players, obviously. You have the better tacticians as coaches. But again, it depends on why you watch football. If you watch football to see, you know, a tactical masterclass, then by all means, go ahead and watch the Premier League. But me personally, I prefer the human stories. So again, it just depends why you watch it. And for me, that's it.
I want to add something about international football in general, right? When you guys talk about like the level and the stuff like that, and the great tacticians moving away, I feel something that hasn't been talked about much, not just on this podcast, but like in general about in the international community about international football, is that because there's, you know, only a few times where you see it, there's a 2-week break, you know, a couple of times a year, and then there's a tournament every other year, which isn't really much. I don't think you really can judge a team's quality on that. Like, say a team like France, they have one of the best squads in the world at the moment, arguably the best. They have a decent coach, you know, one of the best in international football terms, yet they don't always, you know, overperform at international tournaments. They don't always do really, really well. And is it because of form? Is it because of something else? When it comes to club football in a league, because the teams come out every single weekend, you can see if it's because of form or something like that. Whereas on international football, you judge the team's quality on those few performances you see. So I feel that maybe, you know, they may be misleading.
Yeah, and also I think you have to you kind of have to go back to the regular, maybe the less regular football watcher. I mean, I started off just watching, you know, World Cup, Euros, and then I became hooked on club football. You know, we are experiencing oversaturation. You know, there's more and more football being played every single year, and we are kind of hooked. You know, when we go through this withdrawal period of international break, we go a little bit insane. But that you do have to take into account some of people I know, certainly in the United States, and probably in other countries too, who only really you know, pay attention when it is the internationals. So while it might be a nuisance, it is necessary.
That's actually a really good point, because it's not just about you know, about what countries in, like in the States. It's also you know, here in Europe, even though football is so big and, you know, pretty much everyone talks about it, it is a very gendered sport. I think you'd all agree, especially when it comes to viewership. But the thing is, right, taking for example my mother, she doesn't follow club football at all. But when it comes to international football, because it's your country, you care. And in a way, it can be both an entry-level sort of football, because like Zach said, some people, you know, may start out watching the World Cup, something like that. And it's also something that many people can relate to. You know, relating to a club isn't always as easy as relating to your country.
Very, very true. My girlfriend is exactly the same, actually. She hates football, but she loves international football.
Yeah.
It's a completely different vibe.
And personally, as somebody that pays attention to international football more than club football, I think you can get both the best of both worlds. Apologize. When you follow international football, because me, I'll end up following Algerians, you know, all over the place during club football. So I get a whole day where I can watch, you know, 6 or 7 matches per day, and I'm watching Algerian play. I'm watching Issa Mondi play at Real Betis, and then Rashid Gita at Lyon, Riyad Mahrez at Leicester, and so I get the best of both worlds. I get to follow club football, and then when it's international break, get to really delve into it, you know. Whereas I guess people that just follow a club are the ones that are experiencing those withdrawal symptoms. Yeah.
I wanted to, like, because that was something that was brought to my attention recently, right? There are certain nations where all the players play within the league. Like, if you're a German, you can watch the league and watch the national team and, you know, still watch the same group of players the whole year round. Yet, I'm Belgian, and there's no one from our, there's two players from our entire national team playing in the Belgian league, which forces me to watch players around the world, like you said, with the Algerian national team. And once again, that brings back to the idea that it may be sort of like a gateway football, it may be sort of like the way that people can link out to all the other leagues.
Yeah. And let me tell you, like, when Algeria qualified for the World Cup in 2010, that was the first time we'd qualified in 24 years as well. And I had never seen anything like it. I mean, for a long time, our team were straight doo-doo. We weren't qualifying to any tournaments. Players weren't playing at big clubs or anything. And then over a span of six matches, just the group stage against Egypt, Rwanda, and Zambia, over a span of six matches, and each match was separated by maybe 2 months, you would just see all the Algerians in my city. Maybe there was like 20 families. It's not a big amount, maybe 100 people. Everybody's just all of a sudden perking up, paying attention, and you should have the hunger. You're just waiting for those next 2 months to pass to just get to that next match and that next match, and it's building and building and building. Like I said, it's very rare to experience something like that at a club level, I think. You'd have to maybe point at Leicester. But the Leicester stories are very rare, I would think. And again, you guys might correct me, but I think they're very rare. It's easier to find those stories and that emotion, I think, in international football.
Well, yeah, I think definitely. When it comes to football and like nationalism, almost, like, it really brings a nation together, and that's one of the most beautiful things about football.
And partly due to globalization, I feel like it's been, you know, you've got PSG fans, Morocco, and like China, you know, not just France. Because, you know, you've actually got to pick a team. I mean, you have a team that you're born with when it comes to internationals, and you do get more of the human story, I think. I mean, with a player like Mahrez, you know, as Mahir told me, with the story of his father, with the story of his ascent to greatness, that's unbelievable in club and in international football. But and when talking about just, you know, El Khadra, you know, the Fenix, the story of them. I remember back to 2014 with their great run in the World Cup, and then you got relating back to their rematch against Germany with the that controversial game back in the 80s, I believe, right? In 1982.
Yeah, 1982, yeah.
It was against Germany, Austria. I forgot. But you do have that sense of like revenge. That, you know, I mean, they didn't win, of course. I mean, they, you know.
Well, yeah, just to try to give you a scope of the narrative. I mean, my father saw that match in 1982. I obviously didn't. I've only watched it over YouTube after. But growing up, I told you Algeria weren't very good in the international arena. And my father would tell me about how that one day they beat Germany, how everybody partied like it was Second Independence Day in Algeria, how he and his friends took a donkey that they found in the neighborhood and painted Algeria 2, Germany 1, and they walked that donkey, you know, 20, 30 kilometers around the city. And you see all of that, okay, and you hear about it your whole life, and you're thinking, why can't Algeria be good anymore? Why can't we have a day like that? And then Algeria qualifies to the World Cup, and they get to the round of 16 for the first time, and they play against Germany. And, you know, it's Ramadan, and everybody's watching, and can we do it again? And you came so close to beating the eventual world champions. I mean, it just, like, it ties everything in, you know? It starts from the top with your father and the family and then the country, and everything just comes into it. And for me, that's what makes it really, really special.
Yeah,
right.
For sure.
Also, the space of Gijón, right, too.
Yeah, that was the shame of Gijón, yeah. So you had Germany and Austria colluding to
knockout.
To a 1-0 win. Austria needed to win 1-0 for both teams to go through. And sure enough, Austria scores in the first 9-10 minutes, and then for the rest of the match, they didn't play. I'd encourage, if anybody hasn't seen it, to go on YouTube and type in Austria-Germany 1982, or just type in the shame of Gijón, and you'll see. Just watch the football. I mean, you literally had defenders passing it to one another for 5-6 minutes with no opposition player pressing or anything. So, but that obviously brought about a rule change where now all the matches played on the last day have to be played at the same time. So maybe that was a good thing.
Yeah, it relates to your Eurocentric theory as well.
Yeah. I don't want to bang. I don't want to be seen as a social justice warrior or anything. But. I mean, we're talking football in the end, but and it's like credit where credit's due. Europe's done a lot for football. Europe imported football to Africa. If it wasn't for, football was born in Europe, you know, and then it came to Africa. And the money's there, and the best championships are there, and any player here would love to play over there. But I just think when it comes to the international break, I think, and I understand because imagine you're an Arsenal supporter, or imagine right now you're a Chelsea supporter, and your club are about to win the Premier League, and everything's going great, and match after match, you're feeling great about yourself, and you have your buddies like that you go to Stamford Bridge with. And then you take a break to watch England, you know, and England's been a perennial disappointment, and you hate Jamie Vardy, the bastard, and now he's playing for your country, and it's just, you know, I understand it. But I think around the world, I think if you look at, you know, the population of the world, I think more people enjoy international football than club football. I'd be willing to wager on it.
Yeah, and I think especially for a nation like mine, which is so divided currently, maybe it has the potential to unify it might just be a band-aid, you know, maybe it just unifies us for a few weeks, but it still has that power.
Interesting.
That sort of aspect
also in a country like Belgium where we are so deeply split between two cultures. I mean, it's coming down to referendums over whether we should split into two or not. Football is one of the only things that joins us together. Like,
absolutely.
The point that you brought about football, about international football being bigger, like it touches more people than club football, I agree 100% with it. But I think the thing is, because of the quality difference with club football and because of how often club football is, so many people want more club football.
Belgium is a great... I apologize.
Go ahead.
I just want to say Belgium's a great example, you know, with the two languages. Cameroon had something similar. When they won the Cup of Nations, there was a lot of tension in the country between English-speaking and French-speaking Cameroon.
Yeah.
In 2006, when Ivory Coast qualified for the first World Cup, Didier Drogba and some of the other players succeeded in actually stopping a civil war. And I'd encourage people to look that up as well. It's bigger than a game. It can be bigger than a game when it comes to international football. However, again, it depends why you watch it. If you're interested in tactics, if you're interested in technical football, there's nothing better than the Spanish Liga or the Premier League. But if you're watching it for these stories, I personally like to tell stories. I personally like to consume stories. For me, it's international football. But, to each his own.
What you said about it being bigger than football. Football being bigger than football in a way is true. But there's one aspect which, you know, we don't look at the negatives so much because they don't exist as much anymore. I mean, the whole corruption issues with FIFA, of course. But, I mean, think about Franco's Real Madrid. His foreign minister at the time said that Real Madrid was their best embassy. And you don't see as much of it nowadays, but, you know, it could be used for bad as much as for good. I mean, imagine if China starts saying, you know what, we want to win football. They could do it. They could easily... you know, start up academies where they're literally churning out world-class players all they want.
I mean, you don't have to go that far back. You can look at Abramovich and Chelsea. I'd encourage people to read Matthew Syed's work on Abramovich and oligarchs. And I mean, my friend James Montagu recently wrote a book about these billionaire oligarchs buying football clubs. Corruption is rife in football, whether it's club football or international football. I think whenever you have a sport or really an industry with that much money in it, there's going to be corruption at every level. Me personally, because I'm interested in these romantic stories, I romanticize things. I almost turn a blind eye to it, and I sort of force myself to see the positive. But if you wanted to go the other route, my God, is there a lot of material?
Yeah, but like the idea with oligarchs and, you know, big football buyers, to an extent, that's also I'm not going to say it's as much of a positive as a negative, but it is a very big positive. I mean, communities, you know, communities that haven't seen great football, like here in Paris, that suddenly get raised by something like that, that also forces competition to rise. I mean, the PSG project was 6 years ago, and 6 years ago there was barely any quality in French football. I mean, Lyon were the only real power left. Marseille had already fallen to the ground. And now look at this year. Monaco, Marseille, Nice, Lyon, they've all been picking up their pieces. They found their balls. They're doing really well in Europe. They're doing really well in France. And they're providing for good competition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And also, I do believe that it stirs up issues of loyalty, but also of home. What is home? Because with Germany, we've got a lot of players who, you know, didn't choose their ancestral home, like Ozil and Kadira. With France, you know, the same thing. Plenty of players from Meher's home country who didn't choose Algeria. Abdelhak Nouri, I believe, most recently. But doesn't that also add to, I mean, especially when we see games that, like in the World Cup where you got Jerome Boateng and Prince Boateng going right against each other in the Euros.
That was odd.
Yeah. But it does bring up, I mean, these things can happen because
of course.
It doesn't even matter if you're related to them. Because if, in a way, if you're from the same country and you're both good enough, you are brothers when you both stand for the national anthem and play on that football pitch for your country. And sometimes you won't go with your what you think is home, or maybe you won't go with what your heart desires. Maybe you go with a different concept. You know, I mean, I believe, you know, France has had Benzema, Nasri, Zidane.
Fekir.
Yeah, a lot of Maghrebis. Yeah, you know, who don't go with their home Africa, go with France. And that also has political connotations, too, with what has happened in the Benelux and the government. And so I think that football, it's what makes the world go round, because there are so many cylinders, every single cylinder.
Actually, what you were bringing about the banlieue is very topical for me, because I've been working since November on a piece about golden generations, and especially in France, how, you know, so often we have so many great generations of football in France. I think you'd all agree. I mean, consistently they are contenders for World Cups. You know, Germany and Spain have droughts, so does France. But I'd say they're among the constant contenders, even though they've only won it once. And the whole idea is something. It's quite strange, but. Social cohesion usually brings the level of football down. Like, countries such as Norway and Sweden and Denmark and Finland and Estonia have relatively bad levels of football. And countries that have policies where education is not as prioritized over sport, such as in France in the banlieue, where you can really just, like, you know, go to school for fun. You don't even have to go to class and no one will care, because education is so badly seen, because it's seen, you know, representing the state, and the state is seen as the bad guys. Thus, you know, they're sort of encouraged to pursue football. Whereas, you know, if you're a young person in Denmark, for example, you'd be pushed to do well in academics and not in football. I don't want to get too much into it, because I've been working on this for a really long time, and I'd rather elaborate in that long piece I'm working on. But still, it brings the whole idea of, you know, social cohesion is very true, as we said with Belgium, with Cameroon, with the Ivory Coast. But on the other hand, you know, maybe too much social cohesion might have the reverse effect.
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting hypothesis. I never actually thought about that. It's very interesting, Louis. I'd like to read it when it does come out. I think maybe off the top of my head, I mean, I think there's definitely an element of truth in what you're saying, because I can relate to a lot of Black communities in the United States where for them it's either, you know, basketball or music. A lot of people say that basketball and music, those are the only ways out. And I think maybe a lot of African immigrants to France feel the same way in les banlieues, where they think football or music, that's the only way out, really, because they're not going to receive a good education. And, you know, it's these outer cities in France and these banlieues and all the sort. But I think, I mean, I don't know if we can compare France to Estonia in terms of infrastructure and money and sheer population. So it's an interesting hypothesis. I'd like to see how that turns out.
Right. So I think it's time to switch topics. I want to talk about Ligue 1, because it's after, you know, it seemed what seemed like a decade of PSG dominance. Zlatan's gone, and now we've got an open race. Nice were first for a while, but after Willian Cyprien, who's been the best player, his season-ending injury, it seems like it's down to two now. Monaco and PSG. So what are your thoughts on this season so far?
I guess I'll take that one. I personally have loved the emergence of Nice as a team. I think what they've done with their new stadium, with their coaching decisions, with the players that they've brought in, believing in players that many people wrote off before. I love it. I love all of it. And I'm a big fan of what Monaco are doing as well with their youth talent. I was afraid when they brought Radamel Falcao and James Rodriguez that they'd be, you know, another Chelsea, another Paris Saint-Germain or something of the sort. But I really like the youth policy they're pushing now. I think Lyon may be relying a little too much on youth. And players that they produce, but for me, it's one of the most interesting leagues because of these youth players, of these quote unquote unknown players that, you know, aren't in the media all the time, but are really, really talented. And you even have tacticians who are very, very talented. And I don't think a lot of people pay attention to that. So for me, that's the number one reason why I tune into Liga. And if it's all the more competitive, then that's even better. Great.
Would you say that League One is currently like a money ball league almost, where there is, you know, like the clubs are almost forced to make so many smart signings that it's a bit money ballish?
I want to come up with that because that's actually a really interesting notion. It hasn't been brought up before, and I hadn't talked about Ligue 1 yet. But on a serious note, I think There's not really a big difference between the quality in Ligue 1 this year and last year, right? Let's think of all the teams that are doing relatively successful. Nice didn't buy many great players. Monaco either. You know, they have virtually the same squad as last year. Marseille also. They only bought about two players in. And OL as well. What's the difference from last year when PSG was 31 points above OL at the end of the season? With, you know, I think it was 30 or 40 more goals in goal difference, which is completely ridiculous. The difference is the fear factor of PSG is gone, right? Other teams used to roll over when PSG walked into town. They knew that PSG would win. They knew there was no point in, there was absolutely no point in, playing deep or pressing because it would just tire out their players. And thus they wouldn't be able to get points from the next match. So they just accepted they lose points this match. But with Zlatan going, and because, you know, the start of the season was so mediocre and because there were so many ins and outs, they've all found, you know, their confidence back. And I don't think there's much money ball involved because it's, I mean, of course, yeah, because many of them are pioneering in that sort of technology. I mean, Monaco have one of the best developed scouting agencies and one of the best developed, statistics agencies in the world. If you guys don't know, it's actually really, really well done. They employed a really, really good guy to do that. And I mean, England is doing it more than in France. And I think the quality of the players is already there, right? Most of them have been developed in the academies that are there. And most of the players, when they come to the clubs, are relatively mediocre, like, you know, Florian Thauvin. When he came to Marseille, I think it was either last season or this season. You know, the fact that I don't know that means that he wasn't really, really, really good. But now he's up in the Équipe de France. He's doing really well for himself. And players like that, players like Mbappé, it gives them a level to play both competitive football against teams like Marseille, against Nice, OL, but also football where they can stretch their legs against Montpellier, against Rennes, against Dijon. So I feel that sort of, you don't have that sort of balance in other leagues.
Right, and also I feel like I like this Nice culture because it seems like it's kind of maybe the Leicester of France in some ways. You know,
Nice is done for. Nice is completely done for.
No, I know, but they're still going to get European football. I mean, yeah. They're not going to the title, but they're still going to get European football. And that's really impressive considering, you know, their focus on youth. Furthermore, I think that it's really interesting considering they're focused on getting underdogs and rejects. Yeah, Ben Arfa himself was, you know, he was a reject of several clubs for attitude issues. Despite his obvious talent, he was incredible in the set and left for PSG, and now he's struggling. But now you've got some other players who people thought, you know what, there's no point in trying to salvage anything like Balotelli, Belhanda, Dante, and Favre himself, I think. So for me, even though Nice aren't going to win the title, I really earned a special place in my heart.
Actually, that's really well brought up because I know two, three Nice fans now. Already preceding to the season and because of the season, one of them used to live in Nice and used to play for their youth academy, and it was before they did the stadium move, right? And what he told me is actually really impressive because you know most people in France don't really follow the news like that. I mean, of course you'd know that Nice have got a new stadium. You know, you know about some investment and stuff like that, but you don't really follow other clubs in depth as much as you would in England because of the lack of competition issue. But the difference is actually astounding because they got a new training center, they got new coaches, they got new player liaison managers, a new stadium. They pretty much renewed everything from top to bottom. And an example of the professionalism they used when it comes to youth training was back in 2008 when my mate played there, for the under-18s through to the under-12s, they shared the same pitch, you know, for those all of those levels, which were about six teams, right? Who had to play competitions, who had to train and everything. That was that one pitch for all of those six teams. And they had about two coaches through all of that, which meant none of the players got any individual, you know, individual training. Whereas now they have a really well-developed system. And it really shows that when clubs do invest in stuff like youth training, in stuff like player liaison managers, it pays off, as Nice has done this year.
Right. And moving on to the transfers, possible transfer of Rachid Ghezal to replace Bernardo Silva, because for me, Bernardo has been among the five best players in with Ramos, Messi, Neymar, and Thiago Alcantara. An irregular player.
So sorry, I think you cut out, Zach. I didn't hear the last part of your question.
Yeah, I can't really hear you, mate.
I'm just wondering, do you think that Ghezal can cut it as Bernardo Silva? What do you think he'll be a sub?
Do I think he can replace him?
Do you think he will, or do you think he'll be a sub like you?
Well, I mean, a French journalist announced that that Rachid Ghezal came to terms with Monaco. Rachid Ghezal's out of a contract this year. He's been on a youth contract, so I think, if I'm not mistaken, he's being paid anywhere from 5,000 to 15,000 euros per month, which is really, it's just nothing for a player of his caliber, for a player that scored 10 goals last season. And he's been holding out on his contract. He's been wanting the kind of money Fekir and Lacazette have been getting on these contract renewals. At Lyon. And they don't want to give it to him, which I think is understandable because, as you mentioned, he's been a little bit inconsistent, a little bit hot and cold, especially this season. So his brother is his agent. His brother, I think, has been lending him some money, saying, you know, just tough it out and we'll get ourselves a nice big contract at the end of the season. I know in the summer last year, Everton came in with an offer that was accepted by Lyon, but Ghezal turned it down because he wanted some guarantee in playing time. For me, that shows a little bit of maturity. It shows that he's not willing to move just for money. He wants to play as well. I don't like the lazy comparisons, but he's someone that kind of resembles Riyad Mahrez in that he's really frail, tall, wiry. He's got a hell of a first touch, like Mahrez, beautiful first touch, but maybe can be pushed off the ball and can be very inconsistent. Also good end product like Mahrez. I'm not saying he's the next Riyad Mahrez, but for me, they resemble one another a little. French journalist came out, said that he came to terms with Monaco, so he'll be a free transfer in the summer. Algerian sources have reached out to his older brother, who was an Algerian international as well. And apparently those rumors have been denied. Apparently Rachid Ghezal has not come to terms with Monaco or anyone else at the moment, and they're just going to be holding their cards close to the chest and waiting for the summer.
Perhaps he'd replace another player, Nabil Dirar, if he leaves.
Nabil Dirar, yeah.
Yeah, I like him. But I don't like the move for Ghezal because I think he needs regular game time. I'm not sure where he can get it. But there are some teams in Europe. Perhaps it's really hard to see this Monaco team staying intact, because there is so much quality. I think that, yeah, Jardine outcoached Pep in the second leg, but also this Monaco team has a lot more quality than this City team. Look at Mbappe and Bernardo and Lamar. It's hard to believe that all of them are going to stay in Monaco. I hope they do, but
I guess at least two or three of them will be off. Monaco will be looking to cash in, I guess.
Yeah.
Let's remember, though, it took them 3 years to bounce back from that really decent squad prior to the 2014 World Cup. I mean, Falcao out on loan for 2 years when he was doing really badly, selling James Rodriguez, selling Martial, selling Carrasco. Yet now they're in the quarterfinals of the Champions League and they're actually doing really well for themselves.
Yeah, I think Monaco have got a really good system going on. Even if they sell the likes of Mbappe, Bernardo Silva, I think the model that they've got right now, they'll keep on producing players. As we've seen, like 3 years ago, they had guys like Toto Martial coming through. And now they've got possibly an even bigger talent, some might argue, in Mbappe. So, you know.
Yeah. And I think that, and look, they've got for me the best, their academy produced for me the best right back, the best French right back with Almami Touré. And they've also got this blown door in Mbappe. It's not just money, you know. There is some effort in madness. Perhaps similar to Red Bull Leipzig, another surprise story of the season. You know, it's not just calculated transfers, coaching, reliance on academy. There's nuance to it.
Yeah, I mean, if I could just pull it back to Rashid Ghezal really quickly, I think he would thrive in a possession-based side. I think that's one of the reasons why he hasn't really thrived with Lyon this season. I think he's somebody that doesn't want to do a lot of defensive work and wants a lot of the ball, and he's really good at finding space. So I think maybe he could thrive at Monaco. I just don't think Monaco are going to – I don't think – he's good enough to replace someone like Bernardo Silva or Mbappe, as you mentioned. That said, I still don't see why Monaco wouldn't take him on a free, because you take somebody on a free, I'm assuming you don't have to pay him a lot of money. And at the end, they could just even sell him after 1 year and they can make, I don't know, a 10 to 15 million euro profit. So I think
he's still quite young. So
yeah. Obviously. Yeah, 20, 24, 25 years old, I think. And but my point is, you can flip him for a cool 10-15 million euros to any Premier League club team, and yeah, exactly. So I don't see why that's one of the reasons why I'm thinking maybe there is something in this rumor.
Yeah, I think you talk about the Premier League. He might go to. Is it possible that he goes to the Premier League? I mean, considering how well Mahrez did for himself, maybe there's a future there for more Maghrebi players.
It's possible. I mean, there's quite a few now, with the likes of Sofiane Boufal going, the likes of, I don't know, Wahbi Khazri, Islam Slimani, of course, Riyad Mahrez, Sofiane Feghouli. That's a relatively recent trend. I mean, that's really taken off over the last 6-7 years, but before that, it was very difficult to find a Maghrebin player over there, because in general, they're seen as temperamental, which a lot of hardline disciplined English coaches won't like. They're seen as maybe a little bit frail, technical, but not really playing that smash mouth, you know, lung bursting football that they like in England. So recently, I think with technical development, I think you're going to see more and more Maghrebi players there. One player who I think everybody should be going for is Red Budabuz. For me, he's had the best season of his career.
Absolutely. I don't know how he hasn't moved.
Yeah. I think it's going to happen this summer. I know Swansea were in for him in January. But he didn't accept because it was a last-minute bid and he wasn't sure. I think at the time they were having a coaching change as well. He wasn't sure what his role was going to be in the club. But I think he's somebody to keep an eye on. I think he's going to make a big money move this summer.
So for you, best Maghrebi talent in the world right now?
Oh, are we talking like young talent, somebody that's playing, somebody that's established?
No.
Or just best player?
No, because I think everybody would agree that the best player is probably Mahrez, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
I just want talent. Like one that hasn't really risen up yet.
Somebody most people won't know.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
I like the look of there's a young Tunisian player that left Club Africa in Tunis, and now he moved to Nice, actually. His name is Bassem Sourarfi. He's 19 years old. I think he's one that's very mercurial, similar player to, not similar to Mahrez, but he's an inverted winger, likes to play on the right, and he's left-footed, likes to cut in. I think he's one that we should keep an eye on. I think if he starts to score goals in CFA or in the reserves, he could be breaking out as early as the end of the season, maybe by the beginning of next season. In Morocco, you have quite a few 19-year-olds who are talented. I personally like the look of, I'm going to give you two players. One of them is Youssef Eid Ben Nasser, who plays, I think, for Nancy. He's a central defensive midfielder and sometimes a center half. Only 19, 20 years old, and he's been playing, I think, three full seasons now for Nancy. So since the age of 17 or 18, very solid in the tackle. And there's also Malaga's Youssef El Nassiri. Most people are waiting for Hashim Mistour to break out from Morocco, but Youssef El Nassiri has sort of been the talent at Malaga that's made an impression. He scored a few goals this season, and he played at the Cup of Nations and was impressive. In Algeria, people know about Nabil Bentaleb, but he's very young, only 22 years old, and playing well at Schalke. In Algeria, I'm going to say Adam Ounes, for those that don't know him. Yeah, exactly. Left-footed, plays on the right as well. So fast and so technical. Great first touch, but also seems to have one of those attitude problems. I mean, he's not doing anything to sort of dissolve this reputation that Maghrebi players have for being temperamental and having bad attitudes. Recently, he was suspended for refusing to cool down with the team, for example. But last season, he broke out for me. He was the second best player behind Ousmane Dembele. This season, he's had a little bit of a sophomore slump, but expect Adam Ounes to be a really good player in the future. Give him maybe 2 years, and I think he'll be Premier League's will come calling.
Ojella's up there as well in terms of this. So by the way, that's Bassem Sourarfi on Nice and Ben Nasser, who's actually owned by Monaco. That is an interesting concept as well, that, you know, Maghrebi players have this frustrating, you know, they don't really want to maybe work as much as European trained players, but at the same time they have such a higher they tend to have such a high technical ability, so that might as well. Right, just to finish off the podcast, today marks a year since Johan Cruyff's death. So I just want to ask you, how has football changed since a year ago? It's hard to pinpoint it, but you know, a year ago we were in international break, and you know, what have we seen develop? I mean, we've seen Leicester win the Premier League. We've seen the 3-4-3, I think, come into play a lot.
Yeah.
What are some of the biggest achievements and just takeaways footballistically from this anniversary?
Someone else want to take this really quicker? I think for me, the biggest changes that I would say are maybe that took place. For me, the ones that come off the top of my head are on the institutional level. We've seen Gianni Infantino's first year in charge. We've seen a change at CAF as well. We've seen the new 48-team World Cup. We've seen Fatma Samoura, as Secretary General of FIFA, the first woman, I think, and the first black woman as well. I think we've seen real changes at an institutional level, and I think that's going to trickle down. Maybe we haven't seen the effects of that yet. We've just seen the change over the past year. But I think we're going to see those effects within the next 3 or 4 years. Again, with the bigger World Cup, with maybe less corruption at CAF and at FIFA, and hopefully, we cross our fingers, it's going to be good for the game.
Yeah, I would say that the 3-4-3 is probably the biggest takeaway tactically. I think that's responsible mostly for Conte. Antonio Conte, but it also lends itself to others. And Cruyff himself did pioneer that. You know, we started off early in the season with the 3-4-3 of wingbacks, but now we've seen Barcelona revert to the Cruyff 3-4-3 with you know, two central midfielders, defensive midfielder, and Messi in that diamond role. So I think I like to think that's a special load, and it does help Barcelona too. I think that's the best fit. One player you'd say from this anniversary who's broken out the most, you know, came from nothing to something.
Off the top of my head, Kylian Mbappe, just because he's the talk of the town.
I'm gonna have to throw in Kante there.
N'Golo Kante as well. Yeah,
I'm gonna go with Mahrez.
Mahrez.
Mahrez. Sorry, it's been a year. What am I talking about? Dembele. Sorry, Dembele.
Okay, I was about to say Ousmane.
Yeah. Ousmane Dembele. Next up for the Ballon d'Or, possibly.
I've got a quick
question actually. Right. After Ronaldo, you know, lose their prime essentially, who do you think will be the next forerunners for the Ballon d'Or?
Neymar first, easily.
Yeah, I would actually Neymar say that. Yeah, I would actually say that Neymar has been the best player in the world in 2017. I might get some flack from Barca fans. I'm going to say Neymar. Mayer, what about you?
I honestly don't know. I don't think I've been paying attention that closely. I like the way Neymar's been playing. He's definitely probably up there. Can I throw a twist in this? Can I say the next African Ballon d'Or?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm going to pick who am I going to pick?
AOR.
I was going to pick a Cameroonian player, but none of them have been that impressive. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick an Egyptian. I'm going to say Mohamed Salah has had quietly a good year. We always knew he was a good player, but if you look, especially at the first half of this season, he was on fire. So I think Mohamed Salah is going to win the African Ballon d'Or.
He was relatively little talked about last year, and so many people were so happy with him.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's been a revelation from Roma. It's been an absolute revelation. I know he didn't do well at Chelsea, but he's just kept his head down. He's done really well.
I'm going to say it might be a hipster pick, but I'm going to say Nabi. For me, one of the best players in Germany. So crucial for his Leipzig side. He's a complete midfielder, you know, can play pretty much anywhere. I think we've seen this resurgence in Guinean players. There's a lot of roster they put together. But, I mean, I don't know if you have any information on why that is, but it is very impressive to see Keita do so well. And especially some other in that region. I think Senegal is also one. But just in terms of revelations of this past year, I think Senegal to have Koulibaly, Ghana Gay, all have superb years. That's very impressive. Do you have any information on why Senegal is coming to fruition? I think that's been one of the most impressive stories.
Sorry, any information on who's going to where?
Just on Senegal. Why do you think Senegal is doing so well?
Senegal, they've always been an African powerhouse. And since 2002, they really broke into the elite. From a player development standpoint, I think they've done a lot of good work. They have three or four academies that recently closed down, and I can't for the life of me remember the name of them right now, but I was talking to some Senegalese fans in Gabon who were telling me about the good work of their academies. But also look out for their coach now, Aliou Cisse. They did a very good job he has a very close relationship with his players, and I think he's going to help them develop even more. But I mean, you're talking about Guinea and Senegal, and West Africa is always known for churning out these great defensive midfielders, just like North Africa has always been known for churning out these attacking midfielders. And just a hypothetical, throwing this out there, but imagine a Guinean midfield of Naby Keita and then Napoli's Amadou Diawara and Paul Pogba, whose brother plays for Guinea, but imagine Paul played for them as well. I mean, for me, that's probably one of the best midfield threes you could possibly have in the world, but fate had it otherwise, and Paul's playing for France.
that is probably the best midfield in the world, like when it comes to international football.
Honestly, I would probably have to agree. I mean, at least it might not be now, but in 3 years, it's hard to see any midfield.
Yeah, exactly.
That's better than that. Right.
It's also like just to like maybe round out here. The whole idea of, you know, predicting Ballon d'Ors, predicting the big talents, you know, best player of the year. Let's remember at the start of the year, Mbappe was so unknown. So was Keita, and so many players appear just all of a sudden. Marcus Rashford before last season, who the hell was he?
Yeah.
I mean,
Marcus Rashford, the kid.
The idea of, you know, saying that, like, we maybe there won't be a great midfielder after him, maybe there won't be, you know, maybe he's the last in line of this, or maybe he's the next in line for the Ballon d'Or, or something like this. I think we have to be wary of those sort of stuff more and more nowadays with the amount of unbelievable talents going through.
Okay, absolutely.
Just one more thing. Where do you see, I mean, with Riyad Mahrez, you know, has had a disappointing season, I think, by his standards, but still shown up in the Champions League, and he certainly showed up against Sevilla as big ones exhibited. Do you see him leaving this summer?
Do I see Mahrez moving this summer? I know Mahrez is a lifelong Barcelona fan. So I know that was
Zach. How do you feel about that?
Good fit.
Yeah.
I take that. I mean, I know that the right wing is supposed to be defensive, but I think that, you know, it's Barcelona. I've seen Mahrez in an older Barca, so I know his passion.
Yeah. I mean, how about, I saw this formation doing the rounds recently. How about Suarez as a spearhead? Neymar on the left, Mahrez on the right, and then Messi at the top of a diamond or in the hole. I think that could possibly work.
Right wing. Since Leicester probably aren't going to get, like, there's like a 1% chance that they'll be football. So they won't have as much money. I could see that would be a pretty cheap fee, I think. So I would definitely consider that. I think that would be one of my options for revitalizing this.
I'd also just like to say that I don't think Mahrez has had that bad of a season when you put things into context. I mean, he was in the first half of the season, he was playing with a Leicester team that were a shambles all over the pitch. And still, statistically, he's got 9 goals in 35 matches this season. So I don't think he's been that bad. He's really stepped it up.
In the Champions League.
In the Champions League especially, yeah, exactly.
In ultimate Champions League.
Yeah. He's had difficult weeks in the Prem, but also, like, you can't blame him entirely. I mean, the whole Leicester team's been a bit, half of it didn't want to play, half of them were just, you know, lacking that inspiration they had last year, and Mahrez just seemed a bit lost in the middle of it.
But like I said with Gidzel earlier, that Gidzel would thrive in maybe a possession-based side. I think Mahrez is the same. Mahrez is not the kind of player that's going to affect the match without the ball too much, unless it's with his movement. But, I mean, you put him in a Barcelona side that always has the ball, and he has the opportunity to try to exploit space time and time again. I think he'll really, really flourish, and we'll see the best of him there.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, under pressure, if you're playing possession football and you play it up to the wings, to someone like Mahrez, you can really drag players towards him to make a lot more room.
Absolutely.
He can keep control of the ball so well.
It's a match made in heaven, almost. Honestly, Mahrez fits Barcelona like a glove. And with rumours that Arda Turan is going as well, like, it's a perfect replacement, in my opinion.
Yeah, that should be starting, I think. Because you got this. I mean, there's been rumours of Ola, so, you know, it's more hardworking. But I like Mahrez's flair more. I'd go for Mahrez. He's younger and he's done more. I just also think there's kind of a mystery, you know, who is Mahrez? Because I know that a lot of people said, oh, he's a one-season wonder, he's going to be the next Quaresma or something. But I think he could make a very successful career in himself. I think he wants to be remembered as a legend. And I respected how he stayed at Leicester for the following season, but I do think that he's shown that he isn't a one-season wonder and that he's capable of making that.
I mean, one of the reasons why I don't buy the one-season wonder thing is because you just look at the tools he has, and you see the magical first touch, you see the great finishing ability, the vision, the passing. How can he be a one-season wonder? He's got everything in his
talent is undeniable.
He definitely isn't a one-season wonder right now. That's like, that's definitely sure. But, like, the question for me so far has been whether, you know, is he going to stay in England and create himself a legacy there, Or is he going to go overseas? Because if he goes to somewhere like Barcelona, if he goes to somewhere like PSG, if he goes to somewhere like Bayern Munich, I'm just really spitting out big names here, and he ends up not doing as well, how will he be remembered? You know, he'll be remembered having won the Prem and then after that having done nothing. Whereas in the Premier League, maybe he does have a higher chance of continuing his success.
Yeah. I mean, he is Parisian, so that would be a return back home, but he said that he doesn't want to go back to France. And I don't see him moving anywhere else in the Premier League unless it's Arsenal, actually, who he seems to like them. And then, but I think he really wants to move to Barcelona, and I think that'd be his dream move, and I think Barcelona know that. And I think that's where he's likeliest to go. However, to tie this all back to the very beginning, I don't care if Mahrez is a flop for the next 4 or 5 years as long as he wins the World Cup with us in 2018.
I hope I mean, no, Italy, Spain, they've already had their time to shine. I'm pulling for the Phoenix in 2018.
Do you guys think that an African team will finally make the World Cup semi-final?
Ooh, there's a lot of big quality in the club. I mean, last time was 2010, right? And 2010 was like there was so much abysmal. There was so much abysmal playing for so many teams. I don't see many teams just, you know, flipping around.
You know, I'll say this. I mean, if you give them, I don't know how many places they're going to get in this 48-team World Cup. But I think there's a very clear difference between maybe the top 10 teams in Europe and the top 15 teams in Europe. Yeah, but in Africa, I think there's not a lot of difference between the top 5 and the top 10 teams. I mean, you're going to be bringing teams in like Senegal, like Mali, teams that are very good, that have a lot of good players. So I think that the expansion in format will actually help African nations. It'll increase their chances of getting to the semifinals. So,
how many African nations qualified before? Was it just...
It was five, and it was five, and before Issa Hayatou left, he asked FIFA for 9.5 places, and apparently they're going to give Africa 9. So that's definitely going to increase the chances.
Yeah,
that's good news.
I need to see that happen because I've actually got a Mahrez Leicester jersey from last year, and I don't want to see it go to waste.
Now, but you keep that jersey, man. It's Mahrez at Leicester is legendary, man. Like, he will always be remembered as that guy that, you know, played a huge part in Leicester's win. So it's no shame in having a Mahrez Leicester jersey, in my opinion.
I've already bought a Bazur from Ajax jersey. I think it isn't one of my worst purchases.
Yeah, that's that. Now, that is really bad.
Yeah. No, I think that just tied off. I would really like to see Leicester become an oasis of African talent. So yeah, but I would love to see Mahrez go to Barcelona. Well, I think we're gonna. That's it. So Maher, thank you so much for being our guest this week.
No, it's an honor. Thanks for having me on, guys. Really appreciated it, and I thought it was a really good talk.
Right. Thank you very much.
Right. Here with
you guys.
Jack Meher Mazahi. I'm Zach Lewin. Thomas Anderson, of course. We'll be back. The English version in 2 weeks and Spanish version in 1 week. Great talking to you guys.
Thanks once again, all of you, for joining in. And as Zach said, see you next week for the Spanish one and the week after for the English one. Goodbye.